Good evening. James McCanney here with My Science Hour. It is February 12, 2015, and a couple quick announcements going right into the main science topic. I'll be doing some real science issues on electrical conditions, that some things you should know about. Something called shielding, and I've talked about this many times before, but I'm going to dive into a couple new aspects about this. By the way, these shows also are primers for the courses that I will be distributing here. You should be seeing those appearing on the webpage any day now. I'll be talking about that. And these are full-level, university-level astronomy, astrophysics, space science courses based on the scientific work that I've developed. But first of all, let me just explain a little bit about the history. And shielding is deals with electricity and magnetism. Now there's a, let's first talk about gravity. Gravity seems to work through everything. In other words, there's no way to shield gravity. You know, people talk about anti-gravity machines or various different topics, kind of futuristic topics about gravity. But an anti-gravity machine is literally something that uses another type of force. It could be chemical propulsion. It could be steps on a ladder. It could be electromagnetic forces, but some other force. It could be steam engine or steam power or something like that. In the case of the V-2 rocket, which was launched with steam, you might call that an anti-gravity force. But the bottom line is that gravity literally works through all types of shielding that we are aware. However, electricity and magnetism, you can shield them. You can block their effects. And in fact, this happens every day when you have a coaxial cable with the signal coming for television or internet or whatever type of electromagnetic signal you have on a cable, a coaxial type cable, that is shielded, and the signal then is contained inside that shielding. And there's many other types of electrical shielding, magnetic shielding, and electromagnetic shielding. So I'll be talking about that, but in the context of outer space. But let me just review the first three DVDs that I already have placed on my sales page, and these are somewhat primers for the disc number 4 that's about to be released. And in a sense, it's not going to be a disc. It's not going to be something that we mail out. This will be downloadable on the internet, and each person will have a time slot. And like all my other ebooks, these will be coded with your email address that you use when you order the product. So the product will actually be coded with the email address, and that means that each person has their own individual copy of the course, starting with disc number 4. But let me review what's in the first three discs that are physical discs, DVDs. Disc number 1 and 2 are literally discs that cover 8 of the historically important DVDs that I had recorded throughout my history going back into the 1980s. Actually, of course, they were not recorded in digital format. They were recorded with VHS. And some of them on other formats, some other higher definition versions of magnetic tape, you might call them. But and then I had them all remastered a number of years ago into DVD format, high definition, and then they were placed on a 2-disc set. So that's disc number 1 and 2, 8 historically important lectures that I gave throughout my history. And of the many, many, many that I have recordings of, those were the ones that I picked that would fit on a 2-DVD set. Okay, so disc number 3 of the DVD set, and by the way, this does not include my audio CDs, so those are some other discs. You can read about those on the webpage. For example, the two CD set of MP3 lectures, 18 hours of lectures dealing with the physics of ancient celestial disasters. But those are CDs with just voice. The DVDs are videos. So disc number 3, I've already described number 1 and 2. Disc number 3 is the first of a 20 DVD set, and it somewhat sets the stage for cosmology. In other words, it's the broad paintbrush of how the universe works. And the one thing I'll talk a little bit about tonight is finally, scientists are coming out of the woodwork and saying, hey, this Big Bang, black holes, none of this works. There is no such thing as a black hole. There was no Big Bang. And some scientists are actually coming out of the woodwork, but I'll actually talk about that in a few minutes. But what I did in disc number 3, which actually has been out and released for quite a few years now, maybe as many as 5 years, was to set the stage for this 20 DVD set. Primarily, when you deal with cosmology, gravity is the primary mover and shaker. There are electrical effects, but you have to understand them in context. There's some non-scientists, I would call them, running around the internet trying to talk about things like electric universe, a term that I coined back in the early days, back in my Cornell days, 1979 to 81. But electricity has to be understood in context, and that's why I'm talking about shielding tonight. Electrical things don't just pop up and happen in outer space. There are electrical and magnetic effects, but you have to put them in context because it's literally true. There's a type of physics that it basically states that if there's an electrical phenomenon or if there's a magnetic phenomenon, very quickly, it's called Chapman physics, is the basis of it. And back in the early days when Hans Alvin was working, he won a Nobel Prize for discussing electromagnetic effects in outer space. When he was working on the European side of the coin, a guy in the United States was developing what has become kind of the basis for standard science astrophysics in the Western Hemisphere, in the United States primarily, basically stating that outer space is electrically neutral. And I've gone through all of these physics problems myself. I have a very good background in physics, and my advanced degree is in physics. My college bachelor's degree is a double major, physics and mathematics. But I've done all of the problems that all of the scientists have done who've gone through this route of study. And shielding is a situation, okay, here's how you would describe it. Take a charge, any kind of a charge, an electrical charge, and put it out into outer space where you have a lot of free charge. You have positive and negative free charge floating around in outer space, typically balanced, but let's imagine you could move a charged object out into the middle of what we call plasma very quickly. In literally seconds, that if this was a negatively charged object, the positive charge would surround it very quickly, and outside of that shield of positive charge, you wouldn't know that that negative charge was there. It would be shielded. And so, given that there's a balance of charge in the universe, of positive and negative charge, which one can only assume that there is a balance, because when we talk about all the forms of production of particles, they always are produced in pairs. And so, at any rate, the end result is that if you put some kind of a charged object in outer space, it quickly becomes shielded. So it's not there anymore. Literally, electrically, it's not there. And as I said at the beginning, gravity doesn't work that way. you cannot put some kind of a magical Star Trek shield around some object and shield the gravity. Gravity literally goes through. It goes through the ionosphere, which is electrically charged, basically capacitor at the upper edge of our atmosphere. It goes through the Van Allen belts. It goes through the magnetosphere that surrounds farther out in outer space. The sun has a cloud of relativistic electrons around it we call the solar corona. The gravity of the sun goes through there completely unaffected. So people who think that gravity is somehow related to electromagnetism, I have some news for you. Anything dealing with electromagnetism can be shielded, but gravity does not. There's no known way to shield gravity. It works precisely as it would work if there were no electromagnetic effects, etc. Now, there are some general relativistic considerations, but when we're dealing with things like the solar system, the planets, the sun acting on the motion of the planets, there's no possible way to shield gravitation. It's just that simple. And so you can separate electromagnetism from gravity simply by making that simple statement. Gravity is very different. It's a very different animal. But in Chapman physics, and they're right about that, I will say that, and then I'll explain the corrective measures you have to take when really understanding the electrical nature of the solar system and galaxies, etc. If you take a charged particle, yeah, the Chapman physics is correct. It'll be shielded very quickly. And so all of the PhD space scientists, astrophysicists, astronomers have grown up, gotten their PhDs, thinking that space is electrically neutral. Many years ago, I was invited to be on the Coast to Coast AM radio show and debate Dr. David Morrison, top scientist from NASA dealing with comets, dealing with near-Earth objects. That's his primary focus now, but he was Carl Sagan's student, and so on and on and on. But I debated David Morrison, and before the debate, we called each other on the telephone and talked and kind of set the ground rules that there would be no personal jabs of any kind, that we would simply discuss the scientific merits of etc. And I won that debate by a call-in vote. But during that debate, the point I want to make is during that debate, we came to the topic of charged objects in outer space. And he said, we have measured, meaning NASA has measured the electric neutrality of space. And I said, okay, well, how did you do that? And I know exactly what his answer would be. He said they have counters, particle counters on the satellites, and all of the various satellites have particle counters, protons and electrons and the positively charged particles versus negatively charged particles. And they're always exactly the same. And I said, yeah, that's because if there is a charge that's occurring there, spacecraft charging, then the spacecraft will charge up to a certain level. And it will, for example, if the spacecraft is negatively charged, then electrons will be repelled in the amount equal to the potential on the spacecraft. So you will only get the number, and it'll continue to repel to the point where you only receive equal numbers of positively charged and negatively charged particles. So they don't understand. And so I made the point, how do you measure electrical potential in outer space? Now, if you go into a laboratory, potential difference, or voltage, as it is called, between two points, it's measured between two points. You need point A and point B, and the definition of voltage is the potential difference between those two points. And so how can you measure voltage in outer space if you don't have two test points that are somehow connected by a meter or a gauge or some other form of differentiating the potential, electrical potential at those two points? And the answer is, you cannot. And it just so shows that very simple concept has escaped the people in Chapman physics. And so I pointed that out, and I'm right about that. And they still don't understand. And I go to scientific meetings. I go to American Geophysical Union meetings. And I talk to scientists there, and they don't understand this because they've been brought up in this world of a non-electrical universe where there cannot be any electrical activity out there. And so they have all of these theories that, like black holes and the Big Bang and dark matter, and the list goes on and on, but they can't explain what's going on out there. Okay, so at any rate, just to go back to the main topic here, on shielding, gravity does not have any form of shielding. But let's take the example of a solar system with a sun, and this is what I discovered in my early work, and this is what is so important, the main discovery of my work. Cometary activity is a secondary effect of what I discovered. What I discovered is there was an imbalance of charge leaving the sun in the solar wind. There was an excess current of protons in the solar wind. And what does that do? It builds up a capacitor. You can see this actively around other stars. And when you go and you take my course that's coming online very soon, all of this is going to become very much more clear. I'm just giving you kind of a talking explanation at this point of shielding. You can see this occurring around other stars, and the reason we can't see this visually around our own stars because we have to step away about a light year or two and then look back to see it. We'd have to get away and have a completely different perspective of our sun. But we do measure this cloud, this nebular cloud that's out there. We can measure it directly, and it turns out that is what they're measuring. The so-called cosmic background radiation is not from the Big Bang. It's literally the noise, the microwave noise that's going on out in our own nebular cloud that surrounds our sun. It's that simple. But at any rate, okay, so the sun has an excess current of protons, and how the sun works, that'll be one of my lectures. The working of the sun and the process by which there is an excess current of protons, but that leaves the sun with a net negative charge, and you can literally see this cloud of electrons around the sun. So the sun takes on the form of a superatom. Just to get back to the main topic, this is a form of shielding. Okay, let's go to an atom. An atom is a construct with, there are protons and neutrons. Neutrons are neutral. Basically, they've discovered that neutrons are a combined electron with a proton, so they're neutral. They have the mass of approximately a proton plus an electron. And so they're the neutrons. You have then protons that are mixed together in the nucleus, so that's completely positively charged. Then you have a sea of electrons around them, and the term sea implies that these are in the wave form, quantum mechanically, but in the old Bohr atom, these are individual particle electrons in orbits spinning around the nucleus. But what do those electrons do? They shield the protons' positive charge in the nucleus. So an atom is electrically neutral. It's the perfect example of shielding. And so our entire universe depends on the shielding of electrical activity. Without shielding, things would be quite different. Now, that then becomes modified when we form molecules. Molecules act like this. In an overall molecule typically is electrically neutral. What happens is the electrons in one atom become shared with electrons in another atom, and that provides a covalent bonding, and that interweaving of the electrons is what binds them together. It's a fairly strong force. But it's not as strong as the electrical force between plus and minus charges. It's a relative, if you look in the scale of forces, there are extremely strong forces in the nucleus of the atom. It takes some extremely strong close-range forces to keep those protons held together. And in fact, that's why neutrons are necessary in the nucleus of the atom, because they kind of separate those protons just enough so there's a balance of attractive force, the short-range nuclear forces, that keep that nucleus together, while the protons, all of which are positively charged, are trying to repel each other and tear this thing apart. That's why when we get up into larger atoms, the nuclei actually break apart, because the short-range nuclear force simply isn't strong enough to hold them together anymore. The short-range electrical forces, the repulsive forces, break of the protons, break that nucleus apart automatically. It's an automatic breaking of the structure. And so at any rate, what I'm talking about here is shielding. So now let's say an atom, like an hydrogen atom, which is the most abundant element in the universe, and combine it with, say, two hydrogens with an oxygen atom forming water. They form at a particular angle, which is characteristic, and all water forms at that angle. Now, there are people out there that talk about the universe being random. There's nothing random about the universe. It's very structured. The water on this side of the universe is the same as the water on the other side of the universe. The entire universe has an extremely tight structure to it. And so going back to shielding, say we take one electron off of that water molecule, it becomes electrically charged. Now, water can be doubly or triply ionized, and so every time we remove an electron, and if we put that water molecule in an electric field, the forces increase. They double and triple, because the overall positive charge that is not shielded anymore is attracted in that electric field. And this is what we see, for example, in the tails of comets. We see doubly and triply ionized water. Now, how does water become triply ionized just when it happens to be in the tail of a comet? Well, these are interesting phenomena. I'm not going to go into all of the details of how comets work. That's another topic. I describe that in my books. Tonight, I'm just talking about shielding. And so the entire universe we live in depends on shielding. Now, let's go back to the sun. And a lot of people are probably listening to this show, especially new listeners, and they're going, well, what does shielding have to do with me? Well, the reality is all of your weather depends on the fact that Earth has an electric shield around it. It's called the ionosphere. And that creates a capacitor between the upper atmosphere and the ground. That's the power source, the energy source that drives our severe weather. So, yes, this has a lot to do with what you do every day. The vertical electric field of Earth, 300 volts per meter. That's a lot. The wall circuit that you plug your toaster into is only 120 volts. You have over a person that's 6 feet tall, about 2 meters, well, a little less than 2 meters, but you have close to 600 volt voltage between the tip of your head and the tip of your toes when you're standing up. That's a lot of voltage. So, yes, it has a lot to do with everything you do every day. Plants depend on the voltage in the vertical electric field. That's what causes storm activity. That's what causes lightning. Lightning and clouds are part of the overall electrical circuit in the ionosphere. So, yes, this has a lot to do with your existence. Your very existence depends on a very tight balance between, you might say, well, 300 volts per meter, why isn't there lightning just zapping all over the place? Well, that's due to the fact that your body contains 98% water, or something like that. It's a very high percentage of water. But the atmosphere contains what we call a dielectric. All of the molecules in the atmosphere have the ability, they have an internal, what we call a dielectric. The plus kind of wanders to one end of the molecule, and the negative charge wanders to the other end of the molecule. And even though it is neutral, it is electrically neutral, there is a slight, an extremely slight imbalance of where those electrons and protons are located, which gives in an electric field, and only in an electric field. These tend to align. Okay, but in the warm atmosphere, the molecules are moving around, bouncing around, and they're typically out of alignment. That heat energy is enough to cause them to spin and move out of a electrical alignment. So all of these little electric dipoles do not align. Back in the early 1900s, a guy named Tesla understood some certain principles. He didn't understand where the vertical electric field came from. He knew it was there. And I believe he got some of his information from the ancients who were building towers that could collect electricity from the air. One time I was on the Art Bell Show, and we were discussing this very topic. And he said, he gave an example of his ham radio antenna, which I forget was big. I'll just use 30 meters as an example, 100 feet tall. And it was a big circular antenna. And he said, I can measure the voltage, and he had a large number, I forget the exact value, the voltage between the top of the antenna and the bottom of the antenna, and he could measure that. And he said, how is that? How come there isn't like a tremendous activity going on because of this vertical electric field? And I said, that's because of the dielectric. It shields it. Now let's look at something called a capacitor. I talk about the solar capacitor. I talk about the ionospheric capacitor between the ionosphere and ground, which drives our weather systems. Why isn't that discharging all the time? Well, the answer is in the solar wind. The solar wind is a force. In a sense, it sweeps out the inner solar system and pushes all of that ionized material back into a big, what I call, in my original work back in the 70s, I started calling it the donut nebula, or the spherical nebula around the central star on Earth. So that's a sort of force that keeps the ions separated from the central negatively charged star. In Earth, in the Earth capacitor, we have atmosphere. And so that atmosphere is made up of atoms and molecules, primarily molecules, and those molecules have a dielectric constant. Each one has a little dipole electric constant, and when they're moving around, they block the electric field. Now, in a capacitor, say we were building an electric circuit for electronics to design a radio or telecommunications or a telephone. There are all kinds of devices. They're typically called capacitors. Now they're microscopic in size, but they're in there. They're capacitors, and what they are basically are two plates of conductors that can charge up very quickly or discharge very quickly. They maintain a charge on the plate. So that causes an electrical field to form between those two plates, and you can store charge there. But what happens if the space between those two plates breaks down? Well, all that charge will pass from one plate to the other. So in a sense, they are shielded from discharging the movement of electricity between the plates by what we call a dielectric. It's a material that you put in between those plates. Now you could make capacitors without this, but they become much bigger and much more expensive and much more cumbersome. You can make capacitors with the same electrical storage capacity. You can make them smaller by putting a material called a dielectric material between the plates. It's a form of shielding. Now, coming back to that same word, shielding. So the reason I'm pounding on this topic of shielding is because standard astronomy, astrophysics, and space science scientists don't understand shielding. They don't understand it. In fact, there's a term, you can calculate this. This is taught in schools, etc. It's called Debye shielding length. It is the distance, if you take a charged particle in a plasma in outer space, you put it out there, and then all of a sudden there's a sea of charge that surrounds it until it is neutralized in space and shielded. And this shielding distance is called the Debye shielding distance or length. It's the distance, and it's an actual measurement at which the, because of the ionic shielding that occurs around a charged object in space, it's the distance after which you will no longer be able to electrically detect that charged object in outer space, in free space. It's called the Debye shielding distance. Okay, in my very early work, when I was dealing with celestial mechanics, the movement of the planets, comet nuclei, asteroids, etc. in the solar system, I said to myself, I'm just going to try this for fun. I'm going to include electric and magnetic fields in this scenario, and I'm going to see what happens. And really, nobody had done that before, because nobody believed that space could be electrically charged. There could be electrical charges because of this shielding issue. And I said, okay, now we're going to take a look at how these charges combine if they're allowed to exist out there. And so that gave me some theoretical things to play with, the equations, how the shapes and forms, etc. And the first thing I noticed very clearly that if you have a big charge in one location, like the sun, and you have a lesser charge out in orbit on a mass moving around the sun, that it stretches in the form of a comet. And I developed the equations. You can actually see some of the basic equations in the appendix of my book, Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes. And in the appendix, I have reprinted what I call the three-part comet paper that was published originally in a book in 1979. It's an interesting story that goes along with that book. I worked on that book while I was at Cornell, polishing it up. It was about 350 pages typed, and a manuscript that was meant to be a published book, science textbook. And a woman named Marie Jones did my typing for me, and I got her name off of a bulletin board at Cornell when I was teaching there. And so we're working, and so anyway, she had some very negative very negative things to say about the physics, astronomy, and space science staff at Cornell. And she was Carl Sagan's secretary, so she had to do quite a bit of stuff for him. And so anyway, that's very interesting that my book, which is using NASA data to show that they are wrong about comets and the nature of the universe, etc., it's very interesting that the secretary for Carl Sagan typed my book. And this is back in the days when we had a correction, she would have to go in and use whiteout and then put the letter right back perfectly in place, and she was very good at doing that. But she retyped that book must have been 30 times before it was done and perfect. That is the basis of the three-part comet paper that was later printed in and submitted to astrophysics journals. Two of the papers got published until the space science and astronomy department at Cornell jumped on the physics department and forced my eviction, after which I went over and got rehired in the math department. But at any rate, that's kind of a cute little story that goes along with that book. But the equations I developed for this scenario where the sun would be negatively charged and the comet nucleus would be negatively charged, and the shape of the combined electric fields and therefore the motion of charged ions and other particles in this electrical scenario. And so at that point I realized I had to discover the source of the electric field of the sun, because obviously that was causing our weather. Obviously the Earth was involved in this discharge of the solar electric field. But I had to discover from where this electric field came from and why it was never detected. Well, first of all, if you don't ever look for it, you're never going to find it. And with the Chapman physics, with the belief that outer space was electrically neutral, they never were able, and plus these scientists were, like I've always said, most astronomers, astrophysicists, and space scientists have very weak backgrounds in basic physics. They have moved off into kind of never land, general relativity, black holes, dark matter, the Big Bang, and they move into that too quickly and they forget their basic physics 101. That's where I have an extremely good background in physics, and I had this objective view where I was not tied to those archaic, outdated theories that they were using. So I had to figure out where this electric field came from and why it was so difficult to detect. The reason it's difficult to detect is because when you send a satellite out into outer space, it adopts the electrical potential of the region where it is moving. And so it can never see, because of shielding, it can never see the voltages. It always thinks it's electrically neutral. Isn't that interesting? But you can see the effects of the discharge of the solar capacitor from a distance, and we see that. You can see it in the comet. You can see it in Earth. You can see it in Jupiter. You can see the discharges. And when these discharges combine, align electrically in the solar system, they enhance one another. So that allowed me to predict weather very accurately, severe weather, when Earth became aligned with cometary activity or other planets, or especially if we had a double or triple alignment, or especially if we had a lunar issue where our own moon came between us and the sun, it would block the solar wind, and then about 2 days later, after it moved away, this solar wind would come pounding in on our geomagnetic field, compress it, and that's what would trigger off severe weather on Earth. And I could see all of this happening in my work. And so you might see where this is going. Standard science, because of shielding, they don't understand how to measure things, because their individual spacecraft out there are all shielded, because of just like the Debye shielding issue. But if you know what to look for in their data, because their instrumentation is all built in correctly, for example, I'll tell you, give you a great example of how I could read data out of their poorly, incorrectly designed spacecraft and spacecraft instrumentation. For example, the SOHO satellite and other satellites that are observing the sun would see solar activity, like solar flares. And all of a sudden, along with the solar burst from the sun, they would see a sharp rise in X-ray activity. But what I noticed was that was coincident with a drop in the electron count. So all of a sudden you have all this data happening at the same time. And now why would there be a drop in electron count at the satellite observing the sun with photographs, with cameras, and then proton and electron sensors, etc.? Why would there be a drop in the electron count coincident with X-rays arriving at the spacecraft? What does A have to do with B? Well, I knew what was going on. The spacecraft itself was charging up to a very high negative potential, just like a comet does. It's discharging the solar capacitor. Since it's building up a very high negative potential, it's resisting the electrons. They're not allowed in. So this is what was happening. The electrons were being resisted. There was a drop in the count in the electron sensor. The electron detector on the spacecraft, and it was coincident with X-rays coming in. Well, were those X-rays coming from the sun? No. Those were the X-rays that were being generated right there in front of the spacecraft. As the electrons were shunned, slowed down, those X-rays were generated right there in front of the spacecraft. But they didn't know that. They would then attribute that to the sun. And so anyway, this is what I'm telling you. If you make a certain basic set of assumptions, like they do, that the space is electrically neutral, you don't have any instrumentation on the spacecraft to observe what should be predictable if space is electrically charged, then you're going to interpret all of your data according to your basic assumptions, and you're going to continue to verify your basic assumptions. And if the data doesn't fit at all, well, doggone, you just throw it out. You don't talk about it. So standard science has no explanation for why there's a drop in electron count at the satellite when there's an X-ray burst from the sun that's detected. There's no correlation there. They don't talk about it. That should be a major piece of data that needs explanation. But if you explain it correctly, then you come to the conclusion that, number one, their spacecraft is improperly designed. Number two, the people looking at that data have no idea what they're looking at. And this is what goes on with cometary data all the time. You have people who have PhDs in incorrect science, and they're sitting on the boards and in the data rooms at NASA, JPL, at the European Space Agency. They have no clue what's going on, and yet they're publishing papers that are rubber-stamped, published, so-called peer-reviewed in Nature and Science and Icarus and all of the other magazines, journals, peer-reviewed journals. And what you have are decades of pure scientific fairy tale garbage. So at any rate, and that's why I'm doing, by the way, my course series, where I'm giving complete lecture series in astronomy, astrophysics, university level, because this is very much needed. The public, people that are going to school, they're people paying vast amounts of money to get an education that is just completely upside down, backwards, and inside out wrong. And then this carries into other fields like geology, space geology, planetary geology, and on and on. There are so many geological features on Earth that are not explainable by standard geology. They have no idea what causes these structures. They try and but at the fine print at the end of any of these university textbooks, etc., how many times does it say some of the facts still are not well understood? I don't care if you're talking about space science, effects in outer space, etc. They're just simply not understood. But and that's the comment that they'll actually make, like I say, in the fine print below. Okay, so back to the concept of shielding. Now, if you let me qualify something. I said earlier in this program that Chapman physics was correct. Well, no. The concept that space should be electrically neutral is somewhat of a correct concept. But I'll say this, it has to be modified that space works to create neutrality, and it works very quickly. In fact, that is the entire cause of the comet being electrical in nature, that the discharge, once it occurs, occurs very quickly, with the electrons being the primary charge carriers. They're lighter, they're close to approximately 2,000 times less massive than a proton, and far more, hundreds of thousands of times, sometimes millions of times less massive than the electrons are less massive than molecules or dust particles that are ionized. And so the bulk of this electrical discharge current in a comet is electrons. But you cannot see electrons. How can you detect electrons? Well, that was one of my very main first predictions when I was working all of the scientific details out. It was back in the Cornell days. I said, okay, the definitive test for my comet model, the plasma discharge comet model, the definitive test for this will be the discovery of X-rays far out to the sunward side of the comet nucleus. Dirty snowballs and little ice balls cannot explain X-rays you know, far out to the sunward side. That's where you will see the electron beam coming in. It'll start to interact with the material that's in the coma around the comet, and that is due to the shielding. That material that comes in and shields the comet, as soon as those electrons, that beam of electrons coming out from the sun in this discharge, start to interact with that, you will start to see those electrons creating, as they hit, they'll start creating ultraviolet light, X-rays, and in big comets, maybe all the way up to gamma rays, very high energy electron transitions. So, okay, so at any rate, the that was one of my main predictions in 1996. Much to the surprise of the entire astronomical world, those X-rays were discovered. It was they searched for answers, and they now say that it's due to some ridiculous process called charge exchange. Okay, where something in the solar wind interacts with molecules in the atmosphere of the comet, and the charge exchange causes X-rays. Well, that's swell, but why doesn't it work to the sunward side of Earth? You know, they don't allow those questions to be asked. I've been at meetings with these guys, the Kerry Lisses and the other guys, the Tom Cravens of the world, and they don't want to talk about it because they know what they're dealing with is incorrect. In fact, on their posters, on their discussions of this, they admit that you need an electron beam to ionize the particles before they perform this ion exchange. In fact, they've tried to do this in the laboratory. It doesn't work unless you introduce an electron beam, but in their model, there is no electron beam. So they just don't talk about that. This is the way science is done in the world today. Okay, so at any rate, back to shielding. The sun has a shield. It's called the nebular ion cloud. It's out beyond the orbit of Pluto. And this is a vast collection of ionized gas and dust particles. And you can see these nebular ion clouds around other stars. In fact, all stars that produce fusion winds have these nebular ion clouds. You can see them because that solar wind, or stellar wind, you might call it, pushes back and keeps this stuff at bay. It creates a capacitor, and within that capacitor, anything within that capacitor has the ability to discharge the capacitor, and it's a rather beautiful thing. I always use the backyard bug killer as an example. The bug flies into the bug killer, and it discharges exactly where the bug is every time. It's the same way in the solar system. It's the same way with weather in our atmosphere, that the clouds build up, and that's where the electrical discharges up to the ionosphere occur, and that's what produces the severe weather down at the bottom of the clouds. That's what produces lightning. It's part of an overall electric field that extends out into outer space, and it wouldn't, our ionosphere would not be charged if it were not for our connection to the overall discharge of the solar capacitor. The solar capacitor literally charges everything in that region, in the inner solar system, all of the planets, etc. And that's why, for example, the Kuiper objects, the planets that are forming out beyond Pluto, I have a posting on my webpage dealing with that, showing why the Kuiper objects are forming out there, hundreds of them, thousands of them, planets forming out there, and eventually they come in and nestle into spots. Titan, it's very clear that Titan, the big moon of Saturn, is an ex-Kuiper object, that other moons around Saturn that are in strange orbits are captured. It's very clear that these are objects that were formed outwards and slowly wandered inwards. Okay, so there's a tremendous amount of activity here as the solar system tries to move towards a neutral status. But there's a problem. It's not really a problem. It's the motivator for all of this. The fusion of the sun, and like I said, this is rather more advanced material. Why does the sun maintain a negative charge? and how does all of this work? That will be in my course lecture work. It's described in layman's terms in my books, which you have to read before you get to the coursework. But one of the very early lectures in the lecture series of university level lectures will be the working of the sun. And so I'm going to defer that more detailed work to the course, which these will be posted in rather an order, and that'll be one of the first series of lectures. So keep an eye out for that on the webpage. I'm just going to summarize this entire topic of shielding. Shielding is very important in outer space. Chapman physics, is it correct? Well, no, not really. You have to go beyond the basic physics problem that you do as an undergrad to learn that space is electrically neutral. It's actually incorrect. And the reason it's incorrect is because they don't go beyond, they don't understand how electricity in outer space works. You also, unfortunately, have a lot of clowns running around the internet today. They're not scientists. They don't know how electric fields in outer space work, and they're trying to promote, like, the electric universe, and they don't understand how this actually works. So, on the internet, buyer beware. That's why I'm producing these courses, because they're going to take you step by step through this very complicated world of electrical interactions in outer space. They're very subtle, they are very intricate, and the end result is that gravity, not electricity, is the dominant source of the universe. Gravity is the thing, is the glue that holds everything together. And like I said at the beginning of the show, gravity has no shielding. There is no way to shield gravity, and that's why it sets it apart from electromagnetism, because electromagnetism is capable of being shielded. Electricity, magnetic fields, etc. I didn't get into magnetic fields because that's a much more complicated topic. Just a few quick topics before I wrap up here. There's been a tremendous amount of publication going on recently, and this is in the peer-reviewed journals, saying that there is no such thing as black holes, there is no such big thing as the Big Bang, and they're quoting things like quantum physics, etc. But the basic reality is that general relativity, and Einstein himself said, at the end of his life, he said he didn't believe in general relativity. That's why he was looking for electromagnetic forces to combine with gravity, the unified field, it was called. Einstein was looking for a unified field that somehow would combine gravity, the weak and strong forces, nuclear forces, along with electromagnetic forces and effects. And that has literally never been found to date. Gravity is very much a part, a separate force, distinct from the weak and strong nuclear forces, distinct from electrical forces, and distinct from magnetic forces, which are a byproduct of moving electrical charges. So at any rate, very complicated topics, but finally people are coming around and saying, hey, there ain't no black holes, there's no Big Bang, etc. As I said, they're using quantum principles to try and make their point. The trouble is that you don't have to go to all of that length to disprove black holes and the Big Bang. You just have to go back to the fundamental work I did once again, and this is proven in a laboratory, the induced electric dipole redshift. Very simple. You can do this experiment. In fact, this would be great for some kids to do, to repeat the experiments. You take a laser, you take a Tesla coil, which has a pin, like a metal pin as a point. You shine the laser over the top of the Tesla coil, which is alternating voltage. Say the one I used was around 300,000 volts, positive and negative, with a 60 cycle frequency. and you just shine the laser beam across the top of this. When you turn on the Tesla coil, it stretches the beam down, and you can do this in a classroom. I've done it in a classroom. I've done it out in a hallway where you can measure quite nicely down a hallway the bending of the light. So the light is actually bent around stars, etc., because of the non-uniform electric field, and this you can prove in a laboratory very easily. So you can show that general relativity is not the cause of bending of light or of redshifts that leave massive heavy objects. The problem is that special relativity does work. That's very well proven in a laboratory, etc. That's the redshift that occurs when objects that are giving off light move away from you, or if they move towards you, they give off a blue shift. But the problem is, there's a way to determine the difference between the redshift due to the induced electric dipole redshift and the special relativistic redshift. Can be determined from the type of light that's given off, the type of redshift. And so data has to be retaken, but the bottom line is that the redshift that is used to create the Hubble constant, to say that the universe is expanding, is incorrect. All stars, including our sun, give off a redshift. And so the universe is not expanding. There is no indication that there was a Big Bang. The universe, as far as we can tell, it's like walking into a forest. You walk into a forest, you see new seedlings, you see old trees, you see full-growth trees, you see trees falling over and rotting. And that's what we see when we look out into the vast universe. We see all stages of galactic development, of stellar development. And so that's what we're looking at. We're looking at an ongoing process, and there's no indication that there was any beginning or there's going to be any end. So we're just somewhat in the middle, and I would say that it's would be very difficult for man in his current state to make any kind of an estimate of where the universe began or where it's going. We're still at a loss to understand everything that's going on. And so that's why when I start the lecture series, and you'll be downloading these large files, that's why I start with the cosmological topics, because you have to get through those before you can understand what causes a star to form or a planetary system. Okay, so just a quick few comments here. The SpaceX Falcon that exploded a few weeks ago, another explosion as this one was trying to land. Is there someone out there causing all of these private space program explosions to occur? Be aware of your Samsung or other smart TV. They are listening to you, everything you say. And beware of new next generation firewalls. They are not going to protect you. They're going to have taps directly into the NSA. So that's going to be sold to you very shortly. So watch out. This is Jim McCanney. Remember my webpage, jmccsci.com. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.